Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, 13 books, one nation. Novelist and poet Jay Parini set out to list the key books that, he says, helped create the intellectual and emotional contours of this country. That is an invitation to argument and to the question of what sway books still hold, but it's also just plain rich and fun this hour. On Point, 13 books that shaped the country. You can join the conversation. Can the idea of this country as it's evolved be found in a baker's dozen books? And what would be on your list? Joining me now is Jay Parini, prolific novelist, critic, poet, and literary biographer. He's a professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College in Vermont. He's written biographies of Frost, Faulkner, and Steinbeck. None of them made his list. His latest novel is The Apprentice Lover. His latest book of verse is The Art of Subtraction. His list is at the heart of a new book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Jay Parini, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom, for having me on the show. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. I wish, before we go one step further, I wish you just wing straight down your list. We'll talk about each, but just give us your list straight up. And listeners, you can also see it at our website, onpointradio.org. 13 books. Name them, Jay.
Okay, here's the list. I begin with William Bradford's wonderful description of what happened with the Pilgrims when they landed at Plymouth Rock. It's called Of Plymouth Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go on to The Federalist Papers by the anonymous author Publius, who was really, you know, Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay.
Mm-hmm.
Then I move into The Autobiography of Ben Franklin, one of my favorite books. That's followed by The Journal of Lewis and Clark, the story of their wonderful journey west to find a Northwest Passage. Then I go on to Walden, great Henry David Thoreau account of living in his cabin by Walden Pond. Then I move into Uncle Tom's Cabin, the book that really stirred things up and got everybody ready for the Civil War. After that, I do The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which, remember, Hemingway said was the great American book. He said all books come from Huckleberry Finn, all American books. Then I go on to The Souls of Black Folk, wonderful sequence of essays by W.E.B. Du Bois, African-American writer. And his book was really written in tandem with Up from Slavery, Booker T. Washington, which came out 3 years before. Then I go on to the book that gave me my title, The Promised Land. It's probably the least known book on my list. It's by Mary Anton. Mm-hmm. She was a Jewish woman from the Pale of Settlement who came to this country in the late 19th century with the great wave of immigration and wrote this very heartfelt, beautiful immigration memoir. After that, I do How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, a book that's meant a great deal to me throughout my life. Then I do The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care by Dr. Spock.
Mm-hmm.
After that, last two books, I do On the Road, Jack Kerouac's wonderful study of a novel about the American counterculture, the Beat novel. And I end with Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, the book that got the second wave of feminism really rolling in this country.
Okay, great. And so there's the list. 13 books, a baker's dozen. A baker's dozen that you say in toto or individually do what exactly, Jay Parini?
Well, what I was trying for here were books that somehow helped to shape the nation's idea of itself or maybe consolidated or defined a major trend. I mean, these are kind of ideally, these were books that really shifted American consciousness in some direction, redirected. I mean, this is a very protean nation that's constantly reinventing itself. I think that's at the core of the American character. I think change is really where we live. And we're always shifting and changing, although we have some rough guidelines. There are parameters here. But these books somehow they reflect this endless protean shifting of the American consciousness. And by going back and reading closely these 13 books and looking at them as a sequence, I started to find certain themes running through them. And in effect, I think I kind of located something of the American character here, the DNA that's really at the basis of what it means to be an American.
And let us pull it even closer to the claim you're making for these books then, that they reflect a shift or that they actually somehow changed or helped themselves change the country.
You know, it varies from book to book here, but there's no doubt that each of these books to some degree consolidated a trend in ideas that was beginning to gather. And sometimes these authors simply caught the wave and just rode it to its crest. At other times, they were right at the beginning and, like I think with Betty Friedan, saw that there was time to really make a huge turn in American culture toward feminism. And I think she was instrumental in maybe pulling the wheel on this great ship of state and aiming the nose in a slightly different direction. But I make the point that not one of these books stands alone, that each of them is, in a sense, a climate of opinion. And so there's a whole bunch of books that swirl in its wake. For instance, you know, you couldn't have Walden without having the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson before it, without having all the books written by the German romantic philosophers and Wordsworth and Coleridge. I mean, so Walden is coming out of all of this wonderful sway of thought. But then again, he opens up a new path for American nature writing that's then followed by so many writers right down to, say, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard.
Yeah. And I should say, you've got a list of 100 more books at the back of this book, which are kind of the cloud, the big nimbus around these 13, and also some great ones as well. What about your title? It's Mary Antin's book title, The Promised Land, but you've also chosen it as your umbrella title for the 13 books that changed America. Why The Promised Land?
Well, as I read through the books I finally chose, and believe me, it was hard, and that whole, my huge appendix where I have a little mini essay on 100 more books that changed America just shows how indecisive I am. I could have really chosen almost any 13 books because I'm trying to say these are major trends and that so many books swirl around them. And my appendix is just a way of gesturing to say, look, and then there are all these other books that are in many ways talking about the same themes. When I sat down and just reread every single one of the 13 books I finally chose, over and over again, the phrase Promised Land came up, from William Bradford to On the Road. In On the Road, the phrase Promised Land comes up, I think I counted 17 times. And so there is no doubt that America was seen as a place of promise. It, of course, goes back to the idea of Moses and leading the Israelites into the wilderness and hoping to get to the Promised Land of Canaan. And you get up to the mountaintop and you look and
you
there it is.
You see it. It's promised to you.
It's promised to you, but it's never quite there. And actually, one of my dear friends who read the book said, oh, this is so depressing. We're never going to get there. The Promised Land's always going to be slightly out of our grasp. And there is the sense that we never can quite. I mean, who can? Nothing is perfect. Nobody's perfect. We're certainly not perfect. The Founding Fathers knew that even the wonderful Constitution of 1787 was hardly a perfect document. You know, in my chapter on the Federalist Papers, which was really fun, by the way, to go back and reread, I was so moved. I came across in Ben Franklin's speeches, one of the final speeches Ben Franklin himself gave at the 1887 convention. Actually, he was the old man at the convention. He couldn't stand up and read this himself, so he got one of his best friends, James Wilson, to stand up and read it. And Franklin said, okay, okay, they've been fighting for weeks and weeks about, you know, what this Constitution should look like. What was America? How should it actually be constructed? And he says, look, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us. And there is no form of government but what may be a blessing for the people if well administered. And I believe further that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other.
You know,
then
that
he sat down.
That
gave me that sent a chill up my spine.
Yes, indeed.
And it made me realize, you know, we think of these things as sacred. For instance, the Constitution is totally sacred. You know, I get so sick of hearing about these we must elect to get appoint strict constructionist judges to the Supreme Court because of this holy document. You know, Thomas Jefferson himself said every 20 years, we're going to have to revisit this Constitution and do it over again.
I hear the insight and eloquence of Benjamin Franklin as you quote him right there, and it brings a question to mind yet again. I mean, we're going to dive into these books, but do you think these books still have the sway? I mean, the Plymouth Plantation lost for decades. Federalist Papers ripped straight out of the newspapers of their time. Do books still have the sway, the power to change, shape, influence this country, or is that off to Grand Theft Auto and video games and I don't know what now?
Well, look, let me just give you a little context, Tom, for writing this book. There I was. I was actually taking a year abroad with my family in London, sitting there 3 years ago in, shall we say, the depths of the second term of George Bush. I grew up in a family of, you know, my grandparents were immigrants from Italy. My parents never went to college. I felt like America was a great hopeful place. I always saw America as the promised land. Only through the use of libraries and public schools did I finally, shall we say, pull myself up by whatever bootstraps I have and become a professor and a writer and have the life I have. So I feel like so many millions of Americans, I owe a huge debt to this country. I've always been a very optimistic American, very proud of our fierce democratic tradition and our roots in the secular Enlightenment, which is what we are, an Enlightenment nation created from whole cloth in the middle of the 18th century. So I was hopeful. And then I just have seen over the years from the Vietnam War through the years of which for me were terrible years of the Bush administration, this country dragged down and I had lost a lot of my enthusiasm about the American project. Sitting in London and when I began to reread our great texts, I suddenly came on alive. I was on fire again. For being an American, because I realized, you know, this country has always been a beacon on the hill. You know, the famous old phrase goes back to, you know, to the Puritans. And this is how William Bradford saw it when the separatists landed in Plymouth and so forth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a baker's dozen books that made and shaped and changed the way we understand America. My guest is novelist, critic, poet, biographer Jay Perini. His new book is Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Here's an excerpt from one on Jay Perini's list, W.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folks, read by Walter Covell. This is from the beginning when he introduces the metaphor of the veil, the idea that African Americans have a special private consciousness separate from mainstream society.
Leaving, then, the white world, I have stepped within the veil, raising it that you may view faintly its deeper recesses, the meaning of its religion, the passion of its human sorrow, and the struggle of its greater souls.
Just a note there from The Souls of Black Folk. Let's hear from a couple of our listeners and then come to Jay. Harriet in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Jay Perini. What
Hello.
A great list. I really am surprised and impressed. And, you know, it's not the Pop 100 kind of thing. And especially Mary Antin's book, which I've always loved.
The Promised Land.
Pardon?
The Promised Land. Yes.
The Promised Land, Mary Antin. Is, I don't know, I sort of came across it by accident quite a while ago, and I always wondered why it wasn't better known. And then Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. I don't think a lot of people read it, but it's a lot of fun to read.
What would you put on this list, Harriet?
If you considered, or if on your 100 books, Little Women was on.
You know, it's not, but it should be. I didn't put too many novels on this thing because I didn't think novels – here I am a novelist saying this and a poet saying this, but I don't think novels and poems are often – you can't see the changes that they effect. Yeah. So I was looking for books like, you know, well, I think The Souls of Black Folk that we were just talking about really did define the terms of the racial debate in this country for the whole 20th century. Essentially, this book was wildly prophetic. If you take Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery, 1900, and The Souls of Black Folk, 1903, boom, suddenly you see the debate right before us, and it's the debate we're still having. And to reread The Souls of Black Folk in the age of President-elect Obama, I found this thrilling. I just went back to it a few weeks ago and just reread it. It's so lovely and it's so shocking. You know, he writes, to be a poor man is hard, but to be a poor race in a land of dollars is the very bottom of hardship.
But
and that is that, really powerful.
That is powerful. And you're making choices at the same time. And Harriet, thanks for your call. You're making choices right there when you choose between Booker T. Washington and the souls of black folk. Washington had a kind of a milder view in Up From Slavery.
Yeah, and a lot of the early essays in Up and the essays of Du Bois are taking issue with Up From Slavery and saying, look, we can't have this mild approach. He said, Mr. Washington represents in Negro thought the old attitude of adjustment and submission. I have that in my mind from memory. Adjustment and submission. And what I like in W.E.B. Du Bois is that fiery note. If Obama is saying, yes, we can, he has somehow got Du Bois behind him saying, we really, really can and we will. You know, we shall overcome. That note first appears in W.E.B. Du Bois, and that is an extremely inspiring book. I found myself, you know, each of these books took the top of my head off. I had the hairs on the back of my neck. I've got none on my head, so I couldn't have those stand up. But the ones in the back of my neck really stood out.
That's great. Let's go to American Falls, Idaho, and Todd. Todd, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you both. I enjoy your program very much.
Good.
The word promised land, I was listening to your program right the first, and the word promised land is, hello?
Yes, we're right here.
Yeah, we hear you.
Okay, sorry. Yes, the word promised land prompted me to give you a call, and the reason is that your discussion right the first program, you mentioned promised land in your 13 books. Well, I wish to, just want to express to you that there's one other book that mentions the word promised land, and another choice of that is choice above all other lands, and it mentions that in the book 2,113 times.
And that book is?
The Book of Mormon.
A very American book, if there ever was an American book.
Yes,
yes it was. Yes, it was. It's in publication now. There's 140 million copies of that book.
Todd, let us pick it up. Jay, you've got it on your extended list. It's on your list of 100.
It's on my list. I was just out in Utah giving a talk at Sundance about this book. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was in the Land of Mormons there. Mm-hmm. And my wife, Devon, her family were Mormons. And so I have read the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. And I put it on my list of 100 more books that changed America. And the first question that came to me after my talk at this meeting I gave in Utah was, what about the Book of Mormon? And I said, look, this is an authentic American religious text. Only Mary Baker Eddy and Joseph Smith wrote books, important books, that really shaped the American religious experience. And if you would read through this book, Promised Land, you would see that that high religious note, although we're a secular country, created by a gang of guys. I mean, remember, there were no women in those days. Mm. By a gang of guys sitting in Philadelphia, forged this marvelous Constitution and created this country as a legal entity. But
no women in the hall anyway, right?
No women anywhere to be seen. Yeah. There were no women. Yeah. Women don't come along until the 19th Amendment, 1920, when women finally get the vote. But or maybe the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 when they gathered and said, we must get the vote, Susan B. Anthony and this and the early suffragettes. But the note of the promised land, which is a religious idea, that we have an ideal that we can grasp, is there from the beginning. When the separatists came from Europe, from England, on the Mayflower, they had a real hope. And they were religious people. And of promised land, of Plymouth Plantation, Governor William Bradford's astonishing memoir is a deeply religious book. And even in our secular writers, for instance, Walden by Henry David Thoreau, I think this is a book so filled with religious thought and feeling. This is a man activated by the Spirit. He's lifted up and he's hopeful. I mean, this is a deeply religious country, but it's a country which often remember, is a secular country. So every man, every woman gets to follow his or her own track, inner light.
Though the Book of Mormon makes the greater list of 100 here, so does Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society. Todd, thank you for calling. Jay, let's dive in straight to the list. Of Plymouth Plantation by Bradford, who was governor there. And you remind us that there are sort of a whole image that later informed Abraham Lincoln's notion of Thanksgiving and the countries more broadly comes very much out of the pages of this what turned out to be a long-lost text.
Well, remember, Governor Bradford had the advantage of history. He was the governor of the plantation for many decades. He wrote this wonderful journal telling about the Pilgrims and the establishment of the colony at Plymouth Rock. Then this journal was mysteriously lost. It was lost for 3 centuries. I mean, that's longer than from the, you know, America's been alive. So 3 centuries it was lost. A tourist was wandering in 1850 in London and discovered the manuscript, copied it out meticulously by hand, brought it back. It was published in the United States in, 1856. Abraham Lincoln read it during the height of the Civil War in 1863. This story of how the early Pilgrims managed to get along with the Indians. And he said, wow, here is a story of American reconciliation at the beginning. Mm. And he declared Thanksgiving a national holiday right then, 1863. Mm-hmm. Now, most Americans, of course, we are the United States, as Gore Vidal once said, we're the United States of amnesia. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Americans don't know their own history. And one of the things I tried to do for this amnesiac country in Promised Land was supply memory. You know, when you're talking to somebody who's got Alzheimer's, you're often having to supply the memory. And that's what I'm trying to do in each of these essays is fill in America's wonderful, wonderful, interesting, complex history. And also myth-making. Lincoln, in declaring Thanksgiving a national holiday, was creating a founding myth here. And that's what so many of these key texts do. They create myths that we then can live by.
There's a couple of books that echo off one another here. The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and then How to Win Friends and Influence People, long after. But I found a funny kind of echo off those two. What do you see each of them standing for in your lineup?
Well, Ben Franklin created the American character. And he actually created the form of autobiography. Before Franklin, there were memoirs by statesmen or saints' lives. But no average person steps up and says, here's how I created myself. And that's what Franklin's doing. And he puts down his long list of things you must do. You must be chaste. You must be diligent. You must do your work hard, stay up late at night, whatever you have to do to be successful. Now, Dale Carnegie comes along in the midst of the Great Depression, 1936, and writes this truly revolutionary book, I think, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And he's drawing heavily on Ben Franklin here. He said, look, you have it in your own hands to pick yourself up and to make something of yourself, to get ahead in your life. Of course, it's a book for salesmen. It tells you how to become a good salesman. But, you know, one of the little details I discovered was that since Glasnost, since the fall of communism, this book has been published in 28 different editions in Russia alone. This is a book that appeals to people who want to make it on their own and pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
But it's often sort of dissed as a book about insincerity.
Well, there is that, you know, and I talk about this in the book. I mean, there's a great – it also creates the how-to book. And you've got some and, you know, thousands. If you go into any books, I actually went into – when I was writing this book, I went into my local Vermont bookshop and – literally bought every single book on the how-to shelf, paid about $1,000, put them in a bag, and went over to the cafe and began leafing through them.
That's a heavy bag.
And I actually spent about 3 weeks reading things like, oh, there were so many tacky ones and terrible ones, but I read everything from, the purpose-driven life, which I actually found very inspiring, to some really tacky books. Rick Warren's book, and I read some really tacky books by this guy, Joel Osteen. A preacher, you know, and he's – that's in many ways the dark side of Benjamin Franklin, you know, the power of positive thinking. You're going to get ahead in this life, fella, and you damn well better. And also the Puritan idea that God shines his light on those who succeed. And therefore, if you happen to be, you know, handicapped or poor or have been born in unfortunate circumstances, there's not much hope for you, buddy. Sorry about that. But, so there's a little – you get a little bit of that in Dale Carnegie. But there's something inspiring here, too, you know. He says in his first chapter, if you want to make friends, find something good in everybody around you and make it known to them. Talk to them. And so I do talk. I mean, I actually, when I was a 13, 14-year-old in middle school, I did it. I was a very shy boy from Scranton, PA. I had no friends. I was very, very shy. So I looked around my classroom, and I got a notebook, and I put everybody's name down one after the other and found something to compliment on each one. There was a guy called Jack who was an amazing football player. He could throw passes. And I can remember waiting for the moment, and I said, Jack, "You have an amazing arm. How do you throw passes like that?" He became a kid who stuck with me through high school. We became very close friends. There was one girl in the class. I felt sorry for her. She was, you know, there was nothing going for this girl, shall we just say. I won't describe her. And I can remember thinking, I followed her for like 3-4 days watching her. And then in an introductory Spanish class I had in the seventh grade, I heard her say the word burro. And I never heard, it's like there were 14
the
R's
drill.
In the way she said burro. I mean, she could roll that R. And I went up to her and I said, Lydia, the way you pronounce those words in that Spanish class, you could be almost, you know, like Spanish. You know, she would have married me that day.
You've got another pairing on here, in a way. Two journeys, one long and one more intimate. The Journals of Lewis and Clark sits on your list right next to Walden.
Well, you know, there are so many books that are about journeys. It's one of the great American stories. The buddy novel, The Grapes of Wrath, is a journey novel. But our first great journey was, of course, the Louisiana Purchase. You know, Thomas Jefferson suddenly doubles the size of the United States of America in a stroke. And everybody wondered, what was this vast territory? And was there a way to get on some river from, say, St. Louis up to the Northwest frontier? And so he commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, and they set off in 1803 on this, you know, 28-month journey, which was quite extraordinary. And they describe it in these voluminous journals, which have in every generation been re-edited and represented to the American public. One of the things I do in Promised Land is track the publication history of each of these books and how often they spoke to different audiences at different times. You know, every 10, 20 years there was a new edition of Lewis and Clark, which went through these endless journals and plucked out certain passages and in many ways rewrote the book by selection.
And the change to the American culture that provoked as contrasted with Walden?
Well, the change was, this was a huge change in the sense it said to the American people, and when it was first published, a guy called Nicholas Biddle, I think it was 1814, brought out an edition, which was a huge bestseller. And what did it do? It started a wave of immigration. Suddenly, westward expansion began. This was real change. People read the journals of Lewis and Clark, and they packed their bags and sold their houses, and they moved west. They began settling. Robert Frost, in his poem The Gift Outright, has that great phrase, a nation vaguely realizing westward. Mm. And this is what for decades we saw, this nation sometimes peacefully, sometimes violently occupying the land to the west of the Mississippi, expanding outward and we're onward. Now, we get to Huck Finn. It's a great journey. This is the story of, I mean, this, if you think about Huckleberry Finn, I mean, Twain, I think, in this novel really challenges us. He asks us to rethink what freedom means at every turn in this Mississippi River. And I think he invites us to believe in the powers of invention here and to celebrate the cockeyed world of boyhood. He presses us to erase the boundaries of class and color that, you know, keep us in our separate spheres. And he urges us to explore the, you know, depth of pleasure that nature at every turn in the river offers. Needless to say, he does this with his wonderful wry sense of humor. Twain is so wonderful that way. Mm-hmm. And it still seems peculiarly American to me, this voice he creates. And he provides at every turn, even rereading Huckleberry Finn, which I do so regularly, an antidote to the kind of pompous, self-important rubbish that, you know, fills our newspapers and magazines and, you know, clogs the airways most days. Not you, Tom.
Thanks,
not you.
Jay.
You're a refreshing exception to what I just said.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a baker's dozen books that made and shaped and changed the way we understand America this hour. My guest is novelist, critic, poet, biographer Jay Perini. He joins us from Middlebury, Vermont. His new book is Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Full list at our website, but just in case you missed it, it's got Of Plymouth Plantation, The Federalist Papers, The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, The Journals of Lewis and Clark, Walden, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Souls of Black Folk, The Promised Land, How to Win Friends and Influence People, The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, Dr. Spock, The Feminine Mystique, and On the Road from Jack Kerouac. Here's Jack Kerouac himself reading from his novel, On the Road.
So Dean and I raced on to the East Coast. At one point, we drove a 1947 Cadillac limousine across the state of Nebraska at 110 miles an hour, beating hotshot passenger trains and steel wheel freights in one nervous, shuddering snap-up of the gas. We told stories and zoomed east. There were hobos by the tracks, wino bottles, the moon shining on wood fires. There were white-faced cows out in the plains, dim as nuns.
Dim as nuns, he said. Listeners on our website are proposing a lot of others here, Jay, for your list. And Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, Common Sense by Thomas Paine, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and more. Let's get a call from Andover, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air with Jay Perini.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, Jay. Hey, listen. I'm just calling about Kerouac. I was, as a teenager growing up in New York, you know, one of the generation influenced by Kerouac, and you know, I am still to this day influenced by him. I went to see The Scroll. I guess that would be my holy grail, opened up wide in the New York Library in Manhattan earlier this year. And I'm just wondering, I guess I just need to hear. I'm not wondering why. I just need to hear you why you chose this book.
Well, that's a great. Thing you said there, and I certainly read On the Road when I was a teenager, and I felt, oh my God, here is the promised land lies before me. I mean, I think more than one generation of readers has found in On the Road a kind of an appealing mood, you know, an attitude, a way of being in the world. I would just say that the exuberance of youth shines through on every page. These hipsters in Kerouac's novel live it. Breakneck speed, Sal Paradise, just think of the name. He's the search for paradise. And where is this promised land, this paradise? He is the ultimate American quester looking how to live. And he's living in opposition to his parents' culture. You can see how On the Road appealed to the burgeoning hippie generation. I have to say I come from that generation, and I found all of this appealing. But it goes back, of course, to the hipsters of the 50s and the late 40s. I mean, Kerouac was present at the creation of the counterculture, although there always had been, of course, a fringe culture. Kerouac kind of mainstreams the counterculture. That sounds like an oxymoron. But he's also writing about a tribe of people. They live, they're frequenting jazz clubs, and they're living in a kind of ecstasy and perpetual movement. And they refuse to abide, as you know, by the sexual mores of their parents. They're breaking all the sexual boundaries, sleeping with a lot of different women, sleeping. Homosexuality surfaces in this novel, especially in the early Scroll version of it. It's very explicit. But it's also about the search for God, what Kerouac calls it. His character, Sal Paradise, wants to find it, even him, God. But they don't do this in conventional churches here. They're more like Emerson and Thoreau, who, you know, go into the church of the mountains, the church of the woods. They find God in the desert landscape. They find God in the prairies. And they find God in the jazz clubs of San Francisco.
And typed first on a scroll, and the book makes your shortlist, The 13. Let's get a call from Joshua. Tom, thanks for calling. Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut. And Joshua, you're on the air, Joshua.
Hi, Tom and Jay. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Jay, I want to know how close Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass came to being on this list. It seems to me a massively influential book that anticipates in many important ways everything you just said about Kerouac.
You know, that's just a great question. And I have to say the hardest book to leave off this list was Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. I will say this. No book of poetry in America means more to me than Leaves of Grass. It's a book I teach year after year. I reread Leaves of Grass constantly throughout the year. I love these poems. And, you know, as Tom has said, I've been writing poems now for 40 years. I every day of my life, I begin my day with reading and writing poetry. And so the fact that I put no book of poems on this list of 13 books was killing for me. You know, only last April I published a book called Why Poetry Matters. It came out from Yale Press.
And so are you refuting your own title there?
So, you know, essentially I say, well, there's that book and I don't need to do it again in this book. I put Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, of course, on my 100 more books that changed America. But you'd have to say that very few people read Leaves of Grass when it was published. It finally became very important, especially for American poets. And I think novelists such as Jack Kerouac John Steinbeck, so many wonderful American writers were inspired by Leaves of Grass. Allen Ginsberg, poets go on and on endlessly find Walt Whitman, the father of American poetry. You're right to put your finger on this book. If I had a 14th book, it would be Leaves of Grass.
They may not have been reading Walt Whitman at the time of its writing or near after, but they were sure reading Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Uncle Tom's Cabin does make your list, given credit by Abraham Lincoln for the war.
Well, when in 1863, Lincoln welcomed Harriet Beecher Stowe to the White House, and he opened the door, greeted her personally, and he said, "So, Mrs. Stowe, you're the little lady that created this great war." And let's not say that she did that, but she certainly consolidated abolitionist sentiment in the North in a huge way. From the time this book was published, I think it was 52, there were eight presses running day and night trying to churn out copies. This book sold only the Bible in the 19th century, sold more copies to readers in America than Uncle Tom's Cabin. This is and let me confess something here. I never read. This is the one book of the 13 that, frankly, I'd never read. I always assumed it was a trashy novel that was important in its moment. And one Saturday morning, I sat down at breakfast, started reading. I read through till midnight. I read the whole book in one day. This is Stephen King on steroids. I mean, she is a storyteller to beat the band. I mean, Eliza, you know, being chased across the ice, you know.
But Stephen King doesn't make your list, and she does, as an author, as having written a book that changed the country, by your estimation.
Well, yes. I mean, I've read a lot of Stephen King's novels, and I've even seen the movie where people get eaten by a Buick, I think it is. No, he doesn't make my list.
Much as I
love Stephen King, and I do, he doesn't make my list.
But Uncle Tom's Cabin does, and in a very big way. Rot is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Rot. You're on the air.
My name is Rot Ketasinga, and I made an observation that the books on the list are kind of heavy on the masculine side of our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like the author to reflect a little bit on the book that is on the more feminine side, which is the feminine mystique. I would like to hear what he thinks of that book and what kind of influence that book has on our society.
Good, Rod, and thanks. 3 out of 13 on my quick count here, written by women, and Rod asks about Betty Friedan and hers, Jay.
Well, you know, I do talk throughout the book about the whole effort of women to get the vote and to get a true place in society and to find a voice. I refer to the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. This was attended, this was the one Susan B. Anthony and the suffragettes gathered at Seneca Falls and really said, now it's time to create a voice for women and find a political voice in our society. And Frederick Douglass, as I point out, I almost put his wonderful autobiography on this list. Mm-hmm. A very important, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, published in 3 different versions, was terribly important. And he attended the Seneca Falls.
He was there at
the Seneca Falls Convention, an astonishing fact. And Betty Friedan comes along. Like I say, each of these books has long backstories. And Betty Friedan has before her all of the stuff that's been happening for well over a century among women in trying to get the vote and to try and then find a proper place in society. And after the excitement of getting the vote in 1920, when the 19th Amendment was finally ratified, there was a kind of a lull for women's rights. Women sank back into the kitchen, into the nursery room. They were not in public life. Then you had World War II coming along, and suddenly women, Rosie the Riveter, came into being. Mm. Women were pushed into factories. And then after the war, all these men came rushing home. Women had to go back into the home and get out of the public view. And Betty Friedan was just – she caught the second wave of feminism perfectly. It's called the second wave. The first wave would be the suffragettes and getting the vote for women. Mm-hmm. The second wave is when suddenly Betty Friedan and all of the writers who swirl around her and thinkers said, okay, we're not happy. Something is wrong. Men are running this society. We have no voice, no place in the world. And in the feminine mystique – Betty Friedan just lays out the landscape for feminism in such a vivid, powerful way. This was, remember, published in, 1964, around the time of the Civil Rights Act, and for the first time, discrimination. Mm-hmm. 63, mm-hmm. Right? So this is around the time of the Civil Rights Act, which remember, there was a huge debate in the Congress as to whether or not there should you couldn't discriminate on race, but how about on sex and gender.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so it was a big deal when they finally said, yes, you cannot discriminate on gender. Suddenly, the feminine mystique sold millions of copies and set off what I think is one of the great changes in American society, probably in world society. This is a book that really helped to push the second wave of feminism and push women into the workplace, saying that women should have equal pay for equal work. And it was also a book, as Betty Friedan points out, that was actually about the liberation of men. Men had lost touch with their children, with their families.
Mm-hmm.
This division of labor in the household, where the women stay home and the men work, created a wall of isolation that was not good for the men, not good for the women, and certainly not good for the children. I mean, Betty Friedan was not an original thinker. Most of her ideas were taken from Simone de Beauvoir and other feminist theoreticians. But she was just a wonderful consolidator. She was a village explainer, and she wrote in a vivid narrative way. This is a book that anybody can still benefit from rereading.
The Feminine Mystique, number 13 on Jay Perini's list of 13. Jay, reel us back to The Promised Land and Mary Antin. As you say, this was an immigrant from... old Russia, from the Pale of Settlement, the Jewish shtetl, sort of into first Boston and then on, and the immigrant experience right at the forefront of her life and her book.
Well, you know, I actually was going to do 12 books that changed America, and then I realized I didn't have a really proper immigrant narrative. And one of the great genres of American writing is the immigrant memoir. And I could have chosen any one of 20 or 30 that I knew and very, very well. You could even almost argue that of Plymouth Plantation, William Bradford is an immigrant memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, I say in this chapter on Mary Antin, let's not just think that the immigrants are those who came to this country during the great wave of immigration from southern Italy, like my grandparents, or from the Pale of Settlement, or from Czechoslovakia, or anywhere from, say, Slavic countries. No. Everybody in this United States, except Native Americans, is an immigrant and a fairly recent immigrant. I mean, the first settlers to this country in the 16th century, I think we sometimes forget, in the 16th century, were a lot of Spanish immigrants were here very early on, French immigrants, German, Dutch immigrants were here with the English settlers who came with the Puritans. So this is by no means a white Anglo-Saxon country. Everybody's a recent immigrant. And most memoirs in this country are to some degree or another immigrant memoirs. Now, I chose Mary Antin because it's a beautifully written book published in 1912, and it was a book that sold millions and in many ways offered a paradigm for the immigration experience. I heard this from my grandmother. She said, here we were, poor people in Italy. We were suffering from economic hardship. The boot of the law was on the neck of Mary Antin's family in the Pale of Settlement as Jews. They were experiencing pogroms. They couldn't travel outside the Pale. And they hear rumors of this marvelous place. My grandmother used to say, we heard about the streets of gold. And the story usually proceeds. You get on the immigrant ship, as my grandparents did. It's a terrible crossing in steerage. Many people die en route. Bodies are thrown overboard. My grandmother told me about standing at the taffrail at the back of the immigrant ship and watching people who died en route being thrown overboard into the water. And as a child, I heard that story and was just shocked and then amazed to come across it again in Mary Antin's book. Many people died on her passage. She came in the 1890s. Then they arrive in this country, and far from seeing the streets of gold, they realize that they're thrown together with a lot of unwashed millions who are poor. They're all struggling, Irish against Italian, Italians against Jews, Jews against Russians, against Poles, everybody trying to get a foothold and rise up. Now, Mary Antin, through use of public libraries, use of the public school, what the wonders of the American public school system, managed to become well-educated. She was an astonishingly gifted writer. I would defy anyone to read Promised Land and not see greatness in her writing.
Jay, our time grows so short. I have to ask you if these books still hold the same sway in a period where an awful lot of folks are kind of checking out from books, you know, have moved on to movies or video games or you name it. Do these still have that same influence? Is it eternal?
I'll quickly say two things. First of all, everybody listening to this radio program right now has been shaped by these books and more books, even if they haven't read the books, because these are books that have shaped America's character, and we inherit that character at the moment of birth. Our society was forged by these great thinkers. Second of all, I think it's a mistake to think just because we're having this crowding in of CDs and DVDs and television and all different internet, all different sorts of media, that reading will evaporate. Reading is still thinking. Writing is thinking. And as long as people breathe, they're going to read books and they're going to want to return to these touchstone great works.
Jay Perini at Middlebury College, novelist, critic, poet, biographer, and author of the wonderful new book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. You can see the list at our website. Jay, thank you very much for your work on the list and for bringing it to us so colorfully today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And keep reading, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.